instinct was to demur. I feared that one of the servants might report back to Mama, and I don't fancy an argument, certainly not with the New York trip on the horizon. But then I realized that Eliza had the look in her eyes, the one she gets when she has concocted a plan and will suffer no hesitations. The look that has led me into more scrapes than I care to remember over the past 7 years. So excited was my dear cousin that it was impossible not to be swept up in her enthusiasm. I sometimes think she has enough spirit for the two of us, which is just as well, seeing as I am so often dispirited. Before I knew it, we were hurrying along together, arms linked, giggling. Davies was waiting for us at the maze gate, lumbering beneath the weight of an enormous potted plant, and all the way through, Eliza kept doubling back with offers of help, which he always declined, before leaping back beside me, seizing my hand, and pulling me further along. We continued thus through the maze, with whose roots Eliza was extremely au fait, crossing the center sitting area, passing the brass ring that Eliza says heralds the entrance to an underground passage, until we arrived, finally, at a metal door with a large brass lock. With a flourish, Eliza withdrew a key from the pocket of her skirt, and before I had time to ask her where on earth she'd found such a thing, it was inserted. She turned the lock and pushed so that the door swung slowly open. Inside was a garden, similar to and yet somehow different from the other gardens on the estate. For a start, it is walled completely. Tall stone walls around all four sides, broken only by two opposing metal doors, one on the northern and one on the southern wall. "So there is another door," said Cassandra. "I couldn't find it." Julia looked over the top of her glasses. "There were renovations made, back around 1912, 1913. The brick wall out front, for one. Maybe they removed the door then. But wait, listen to this." The garden itself was neat and rather underplanted. It had the look of a fallow field, waiting to be sown after the winter months have passed. In its center, an ornate metal bench sat by a stone birdbath, and on the ground were several wooden crates loaded with small potted plants. Eliza ran inside with all the grace of a schoolboy. "What is this place?" I said in wonder. "It's a garden. I've been tending it. You should have seen the weeds when first I started. We've been so busy, haven't we, Davies?"
"We certainly have at that, Miss Eliza," he said, depositing the pot plant by the southern wall.
"It's going to be ours, Rose, yours and mine. A secret place where we can be together, just the two of us, just as we imagined when we were younger. Four walls, locked doors, our very own paradise. Even when you're unwell, you can come here, Rose. The walls keep it protected from the rough sea winds, so you'll still be able to listen to the birds, smell the flowers, feel the sun on your face." Her enthusiasm, the intensity of her feeling, was such that I couldn't help but long for such a garden. I gazed upon the tamed garden beds, the potted flowers that were just beginning to bud, and I could imagine the paradise she described. I heard talk when I was very small about a walled garden hidden on the property, but I thought it must be a story. "It's not," said Eliza, eyes shining. "It was all true, and now we're bringing it back to life." They had certainly worked hard. If the garden had been untended all this time, ever since... I frowned. The talk I'd heard as a girl was coming back to me. Then realization struck. I knew exactly whose garden this had been. "Oh, Liza," I said quickly, "you must be careful. We must be careful. We must leave this place and never come back. If Father were to find out..." "He already knows." I looked at her sharply. more sharply than I intended.
What do you mean?
It was Uncle Linus who instructed Davies that I should have the garden. He had Davies clear the last part of the maze and told him that we should give the garden new life.
But Father forbade anyone going inside the walled garden.
Eliza shrugged, that gesture of hers that comes so readily and which Mama so despises. He must have had a change of heart.
A change of heart. How uneasily the sentiment sat with my image of Father.
It was the word heart that did it.
Except for the one time in his study when I was hidden beneath the desk and heard him weep for his sister, his poopy, I cannot think that I have ever seen Father behave in a way that suggested a heart. Suddenly I knew, and I felt a strange heaviness in the very base of my stomach. It is because you are her daughter.
But Eliza did not hear me. She had left my side and was dragging the propagating pot towards a large hole by the wall.
"This is our first new tree," she called. "We're going to have a ceremony. That's why it was so important that you be here today. This tree will continue to grow, no matter where our lives take us, and it will remember us always. Rose and Eliza."
Davies was by my side then, holding out a small spade.
"It's Miss Eliza's wish that you should be the first to toss dirt onto the roots of the tree, Miss Rose."
Miss Eliza's wish? Who was I to argue with so great a force?
"What sort of tree is it?" I asked.
"An apple tree." I should have known. Eliza has always had an eye to symbolism, and apples are, after all, the first fruit. Julia looked up from the scrapbook, and a tear slipped from eyes that were brimming. She snuffled and smiled.
"I just love Rose so much. Can't you feel her here with us?"
Cassandra smiled back. She had eaten an apple from a tree her grandmother had helped to plant nearly 100 years before. She blushed slightly as thoughts of the apple brought back echoes of the strange dream. All week, as she'd worked close by Christian, she'd managed to block it out. She had thought she was rid of it.
"And now you're cleaning up the same garden all over again. What lovely symmetry. What would Rose say if she knew?"
Julia plucked a tissue from a nearby box and blew her nose.
"Sorry," she said, dabbing mascara from beneath each eye. "It's just so romantic."
She laughed. "It's a shame you don't have a Davies to help you."
"He's not a Davies, but I do have someone helping me," said Cassandra. "He's been every afternoon this week. I met him and his brother Michael when they came to clear a fallen tree from the cottage. You know them, I think. Robin Jameson said they do the gardens here, too."
"The Blake boys, they most certainly do, and I must say I enjoy watching them. That Michael's easy on the eye, isn't he? Quite the charmer, too. If I were still writing, it'd be Michael Blake I'd picture when I was describing my ladies' man."
"And Christian?"
Despite her best attempt at nonchalance, Cassandra felt her cheeks warm up.
"Oh, he'd definitely be the smarter, younger, quieter brother who surprises everyone by saving the day and winning the heroine's heart."
Cassandra smiled. "I'm not even going to ask who I'd be."
"And I have no doubts who I'd be," Julia said with a sigh. "The aging beauty who doesn't have a chance with the hero, so channels her energy into helping the heroine realize her fate."
"Life would be a lot easier if it were like a fairy tale," said Cassandra. "If people belonged to stock character types."
"Oh, but people do. They only think they don't. Even the person who insists such things don't exist is a cliché. The drear pedant who insists on his own uniqueness."
Cassandra took a sip of wine. "You don't think there's any such thing as uniqueness?" We're all unique, just never in the ways we imagine. Julia smiled, then waved her hand, bangles clattering. Listen to me, what a dreadful absolutist I am. Of course, there are variations in character. Take your Christian Blake, for instance. He's not a gardener by trade, you know. He works at a hospital in Oxford. Well, that is, he did. Some kind of doctor. I forget the proper name. They're so long and confusing, aren't they? Cassandra sat up straighter. What's a doctor doing lopping trees? What's a doctor doing lopping trees? Julia echoed meaningfully. My point exactly. When Michael told me his brother was starting with him, I didn't ask questions, but I've been curious as the proverbial ever since. What makes a young man swap vocations just like that? Cassandra shook her head. Change of heart? Pretty big change, I'd say. Maybe he realized he didn't enjoy it. Possible, but you'd think he might have got the hint at some time during the interminable years of study. Julia smiled enigmatically. I think it's likely far more interesting than that. But then I was a writer, and old habits die hard. I can't stop my imagination running away with me. She pointed a gin-clutching finger at Cassandra. That, my dear, is what makes a character interesting. Their secrets. Cassandra thought of Nell and the secrets she'd kept. How could she have stood it, finally discovering who she really was, and not telling a soul? I wish my grandmother had seen the scrapbooks before she died. They would have meant so much to her, the closest thing possible to hearing her mother's voice. I've been thinking about your grandmother all week, said Julia. Ever since you told me what happened, I've been wondering what made Eliza take her. And what do you reckon? Envy, said Julia. I come back to it every time. It's a bloody powerful motivator, and Lord knows there was enough to envy about Rose. Her beauty, her talented husband, her birthright. Throughout their childhoods, Eliza must have seen Rose as the little girl who had everything, particularly the things she didn't have. Wealthy parents, a beautiful house, a kind nature that people admired. Then, in adulthood, to see Rose marry so quickly, and to a man who must have been quite a catch, then fall pregnant, have a beautiful baby girl. Hell, I feel jealous of Rose. Imagine what it was like for Eliza, a bit of an odd bird by all accounts. She drained her drink, put the glass down emphatically. I'm not excusing what she did, not at all. I'm just saying it doesn't surprise me. It's the most obvious answer, isn't it? And the most obvious answer is usually the right one. It's all there in the scrapbooks. Well, it's all there if you know what you're looking for. From the moment Rose found out she had a baby on the way, Eliza grew more distant. There's very little mention of Eliza after Ivory was born. It must have plagued Rose. Eliza was like a sister, and suddenly, in such a special time, she withdrew. Packed up and took herself away from Blackhurst. Where did she go? Said Cassandra, surprised. Overseas somewhere, I think. Julia frowned. Though, now you mention it, I'm not sure that Rose actually says. She waved her hand, and it's beside the point, really. The fact is, she went away while Rose was pregnant and didn't come back again until after Ivory was born. Their friendship was never the same again. Cassandra yawned and readjusted her pillow. Her eyes were tired, but she was almost at the end of 1907, and it seemed a shame to put the scrapbook aside with only a handful of pages left to go. Besides, the sooner she read them, the better. While Julia had kindly agreed to the loan, Cassandra suspected that the separation would only be borne for a short time. Thankfully, where Nell's writing was scrawled, Rose's hand was steady and considered. Cassandra took a sip of tea, lukewarm now, and passed over pages filled with fabric, ribbon samples, wedding tulle, and flourished autographs, reading, Mrs. Rose Mountrachet Walker. Mrs. Walker. Mrs. Rose Walker. She smiled. Certain things never changed. And turned to the last page. I have just finished rereading Tess of the D'Urbervilles. It is a perplexing novel, and one which I cannot truly say that I enjoy. There is so much that is brutal in Hardy's fiction. It is too wild, I suppose, for my tastes. I am my mother's daughter, after all, despite my best intentions. Angel's conversion to Christianity, his marriage to Liza Lou, the death of poor baby Sorrow. These occurrences bother me, all. Why should Sorrow have been deprived of a Christian burial? Babies aren't to blame for their sins of their parents, surely. Does Hardy approve of Angel's conversion, or is he a skeptic? And how could Angel transfer his affection so simply from Tess to her sister? Oh well, such issues have perplexed greater minds than mine. And my purpose in turning again to the sad tale of poor, tragic Tess was not literary criticism. I confess I consulted Mr. Thomas Hardy in the hopes that he might offer some insight into what I might expect when Nathaniel and I are wed. More particularly, what might be expected of me. Oh, how it heats my cheeks even to think such questions in my mind. Certainly I could never find words to speak them. Imagine Mama's face. Alas, Mr. Hardy did not provide the answers I so hopefully sought. I had remembered incorrectly. Tessa's defilement is covered in no great detail. So there it is. Unless I can think of somewhere else I might turn, not Mr. James, I think, nor Mr. Dickens, I will have little choice but to go blind into that dark abyss. My greatest fear is that Nathaniel will have cause to look upon my stomach. Surely it won't be so. Vanity is indeed a great sin, but alas, I cannot help myself, for my marks are so ugly, and he is so fond of my pale skin. Cassandra read the last few lines over. What were these marks of which Rose spoke? Birthmarks, perhaps? Scars? Had she read anything else in the scrapbooks that might elucidate the entry? Try as she might, Cassandra couldn't remember. It was too late, and she too tired, her thoughts as blurred as her vision. She yawned again, rubbed at her eyes, and closed the scrapbook. Probably she'd never know, and in all likelihood it didn't matter. Cassandra ran her fingers again over the worn cover, just as Rose must have done many times before her. She placed the book on her bedside table and switched off the light. Closed her eyes and slid into a familiar dream about long grass, an endless field, and suddenly, unexpectedly, a cottage on the edge of an ocean cliff. Chapter 36, Pilchard Cottage, 1975. Nell waited by the door, wondering whether she should knock again. She'd been standing on the doorstep for over 5 minutes, and had begun to suspect that William Martin knew nothing of her impending arrival at his dinner table, that the invitation might have been little more than a ploy of Robin's to smooth the waters after their previous encounter. Robin seemed the type for whom social unpleasantness, no matter what its cause or consequence, might be intolerable. She knocked again, affected an expression of blithe dignity for the benefit of any of William's neighbours who might be wondering at this strange woman on his doorstep who seemed content to knock all night. It was William himself who finally unhooked the latch. Tea towel over his knobbly shoulder, wooden spoon in hand, he said, "I hear you've gone and bought yourself that cottage."
Good news travels fast.
He pressed his lips together, regarding her.
You're a bloody-minded lass. I could tell that a mile away.
As God made me, I'm afraid. He nodded, gave a little huff.
Come on, then. You'll catch your death out there.
Nell peeled off her waterproof jacket and found a peg on which to hang it. She followed William through the main door and into the sitting room. The air was heavy, damp with steam, the smell at once nauseating and delicious. Fish and salt and something else.
Got a pot of my morgy broth on the stove,
said William, disappearing at a shuffle into the kitchen.
Couldn't hear you knocking over the bloody spits and spurts.
A racket of pots and pans, a gruff curse.
Robin'll be along shortly.
Another clatter.
Got held up a time with that fellow of hers.
The last he uttered with some distaste. Nell followed him into the kitchen and watched as he stirred the lumpy broth.
You don't approve of Robin's fiancé?
He leaned his ladle on the benchtop, replaced the saucepan lid, and picked up his pipe. Plucked a lone strand of tobacco from the rim.
Nothing wrong with the lad. Nothing bar the fact he's not perfect.
Hand supporting the small of his stooped back, he headed for the sitting room.
You have children? Grandchildren?
He said, as he passed Nell.
One of each. Then you know what I'm talking about.
Nell smiled grimly to herself. 12 days had passed since she'd left Australia. She wondered whether Leslie had noticed her absence. It was unlikely. All the same, it struck Nell that she might send a postcard. The girl would like that. Cassandra. Children liked that sort of thing, didn't they?
Come on then, lass. William's voice from the sitting room. Keep an old man company.
Nell, creature of habit, chose the same velvet chair as she had on the previous occasion. She nodded at William. He nodded back. They sat for a minute or so, in a performance of companionable silence. The wind had picked up outside, and the window panes rattled periodically, accentuating the dearth of conversation within. Nell indicated the painting above the fireplace, a fisherman's boat with a red and white striped hull and her name printed in black along the side.
That's yours? The Pisky Queen?
'Tis indeed, said William. Love of my life, I sometimes think. Saw each other through some mighty storms, she and I.
You still have her?
Not for a few years, no.
Another silence stretched out between them. William patted his shirt pocket, then withdrew a pouch of tobacco, started refilling his pipe. My father was portmaster, said Nell. I grew up around ships. She had a sudden image of Hugh, standing on the Brisbane wharf sometime after the war, the sun behind him and he in eclipse. Long Irish legs and large, strong hands.
Gets into your blood, doesn't it? That it does.
The window panes chattered again, and Nell exhaled. Enough was enough. It was now or never, and numerous other handy clichés. The air needed clearing, and Nell was the one to do it. There was only so much small talk she was prepared to make.
William, she said, leaning forward to rest her elbows on her knees. About the other night, what I said. I didn't mean to.
He raised a work-hardened palm, slightly shaky.
No matter.
But I shouldn't have.
'Twas nothing.
He clamped his pipe between his back teeth and thereby closed the matter. He struck a match. Nell leaned back into her chair. If that was the way he wanted it, so be it. But she was determined this time not to leave without another piece of the puzzle. Robin said there was something you wanted to tell me. The sweet scent of fresh tobacco as William sucked a couple of times, then puffed to get his pipe smoking.
He nodded slightly. "Should have told you the other night. Only..."
He was focused on something beyond her, and Nell fought the urge to turn and see what it was.
"Only you caught me by surprise. It's been a long time since I heard her name spoke."
"Eliza Makepeace." The unspoken sibilant shimmered its silver wings between them.
"Been more than 60 years since last I saw her. But I can picture her right enough. Coming down the cliff from the cottage up there, striding into the village, hair loose behind her."
His eyelids had closed as he spoke, but now he opened them and eyeballed Nell.
"I expect that doesn't mean much to you. But back then, well, it wasn't often that one of the folk from the Grand House lowered themselves to mix amongst the villagers. Eliza, though..."
He cleared his throat a little, repeated the forename.
"Eliza behaved as if it were the most natural thing in the world. She wasn't like the rest of them."
"You met her?"
"Knew her well. As well as one could know the likes of her. Met her when she was just 18. My little sister, Mary, worked up at the house and brought Eliza with her for one of her afternoons off."
Nell fought hard to contain the thrill. Finally, to be speaking with someone who had known Eliza. Better yet, to have his description confirm the illicit sense that flirted on the rim of her own patchy memories. "What was she like, William?" He pressed his lips together and scratched at his chin. The whiskery sound caught Nell by surprise. For a split second she was 5 years old again, sitting on Hugh's lap, head resting against his bristled cheek. William smiled broadly, teeth large and rimmed with tobacco brown.
"Like no one you've met before. An original. We all of us, around here, like to tell stories. But hers was something else. She was funny, courageous, unexpected."
"Beautiful?"
"Yes. And beautiful."
His eyes met hers fleetingly.
"She had this red hair. Long it was, all the way to her waist. Strands that turned golden in the sun."
He indicated with his pipe.
"She liked to sit on that black rock in the cove, looking out to sea. On a clear day, we'd be able to see her as we were coming back to port. She'd lift her hand and wave, looking for all the world like the Queen of the Piskies."
Nell smiled. "The Pisky Queen. Like your boat." William pretended fascination with the corduroy grooves of his trousers, grunted a little. Realization crowned. This was no coincidence.
"Robin should be here soon."
He didn't glance at the door. "We'll have us some tea."
"You named your boat for her?"
William's lips parted, closed again. He sighed, the sigh of a young man. "You were in love with her."
His shoulders sagged. "Course I was," he said. "Just like every fellow who ever laid eyes on her. I told you, she was different from anyone you'd ever met. The things that govern the rest of us didn't matter one whit to her. She did as she felt, and she felt a great deal."
"And did she... were you and she ever..."
"I was engaged to someone else."
His attention shifted to a photograph on the wall. A young couple in wedding clothes, She's sitting, he's standing behind.
Cecily and I, we'd been steady for a couple of years by then. A village like this, that's what happens. You grow up next door to a girl, and one day, your kids, bowling stones off the cliff. Next thing you know, you're 3 years married, with another baby on the way.
He sighed so that his shoulders deflated and his woolen sweater seemed too large.
When I met Eliza, the world shifted. Can't describe it better than that. Like a magic spell, she was all I could think of.
He shook his head.
I was that fond of Cess, loved her, true, but I'd have left her in a moment.
His gaze met Nell's before shifting quickly away.
Doesn't make me proud to say that. Sounds awful disloyal. And it was. It was.
He looked at Nell.
But you can't blame a young man for his honest feelings, can you?
His eyes searched hers, and Nell felt something inside her buckle. She understood. He'd been seeking absolution a long time.
No, she said. No, you can't.
He breathed a sigh, spoke so softly that Nell had to turn her head to the side to hear.
Sometimes the body wants things the mind can't explain. Can't even accept. My every foolish thought was of Eliza. I couldn't help myself. It was like a... like an...
addiction?
Just like that. I figured I could only ever be happy if it were with her.
Did she feel the same way? He raised his brows and smiled ruefully.
You know, for a time, I thought she did. She had a way about her, an intensity, a habit of making you feel that there was nowhere she'd rather be and no one she'd rather be with.
He laughed, a little unkindly.
Soon enough learned my error.
What happened? He pressed his lips together, and for an awful second Nell thought the story had dried up. She breathed a sigh of relief when he continued.
A spring night it was. Must have been 1908 or 1909. I'd had a big day on the boats. Brought in a huge haul, and I'd been out celebrating with some of the other lads. I'd got a bit of Dutch courage into me. And on my way home, I found myself heading up along the cliff edge. Foolhardy thing to do. It was just a narrow path back then. Hadn't yet been turned into a road, and was barely fit for a mountain goat, but I didn't care. I'd got it into my head that I was going to ask her to marry me.
His voice quivered.
But when I got near the cottage, I saw... through the window.
Nell leaned forward.
He sat back. Well, you've heard this tale before.
She was with someone else.
Not just any someone else.
His lips trembled a little around the words.
One that was family to her.
William rubbed at the edge of his eye, checked his finger for a phantom irritant.
They were...
He glanced at Nell.
Well, you can imagine right enough.
A noise outside and a burst of cool air. Robin's voice drifted in from the hallway.
It's grown cold out there. She stepped into the sitting room. Sorry, I'm late.
She looked hopefully between the two of them, running her hands over mist-damp hair.
Everything all right in here?
Couldn't be better, my girl,
said William, with a quick
glance at Nell. Nell nodded slightly. She had no intention of divulging an old man's secret.
"Just about to dish up my broth," said William. "Come, and give your Gump's sore old eyes a sight of you."
"Gump, I told you I'd fix the tea. I brought everything with me."
"Humph," he grumbled, pushing himself out of the chair and catching his balance. "Once you and that fellow get going, there is no telling when you'll remember your old Gump, if at all. Figured, if I didn't look out for myself, I stood a good chance of going hungry."
"Oh, Gump," she scolded as she carried her shopping bag to the kitchen. "Really, you are the limit. When have I ever forgotten you?"
"It's not you, my dear," he shuffled after her. "It's that fellow of yours. Like all lawyers, he's a windbag."
While the two of them argued familiarly about whether or not it was beyond William's physical abilities to cook and dish up broth, Nell sorted mentally through all that William had told her. She understood now why he was so adamant about the cottage being tainted somehow. Sad. And no doubt, for him it was. But William had become sidetracked by his own confession, and it was up to Nell to steer him back in the direction she needed to go. And no matter her own curiosity as to whom Eliza had been with that night, it was beside the point, and pushing William would only cause him to withdraw. She couldn't risk that, not before she found out why Eliza might have taken her from Rose and Nathaniel Walker, why she'd been sent to Australia, and a completely different life.
"Here we go." Robin appeared, carrying a tray loaded with 3 steaming bowls.
William followed, somewhat sheepishly, and eased himself into his chair.
"I still make the best morgy broth this side of Polperro."
Robin raised her eyebrows at Nell.
"No one's disputing that, Gump," she said, handing a bowl across the coffee table. "Just my ability to carry it from kitchen to table."
Robin sighed theatrically.
"Let us help you, Gump. That's all we ask."
Nell ground her teeth. She needed to keep this argument from escalation. She couldn't risk losing William again to pique. "Delicious," she said loudly, tasting the broth. "Perfect amount of Worcestershire sauce." William and Robin both blinked at her, spoons hovering at half-mast.
"What?"
Nell looked between them.
"What is it?"
Robin opened her mouth, closed it again like a fish.
"The Worcestershire sauce." "It's our secret ingredient," said William. "Been in the family for generations."
Nell shrugged apologetically. "My mum used to make morgy broth. So did her mum. They always used Worcestershire sauce. I guess it was our secret ingredient too." William inhaled slowly through wide nostrils, and Robin bit her lip.
"It's delicious, though," said Nell, taking another slurp. "Getting the amount right. That's the trick."
"Tell me, Nell," said Robin, clearing her throat, assiduously avoiding William's eyes. "Was there anything of use in those papers I gave you?" Nell smiled gratefully. Robin to the rescue. "They were very interesting. I enjoyed the newspaper article about the Lusitania launch."
Robin beamed. "It must have been so exciting, an important launch like that. Terrible to think of what happened to that beautiful ship." "Germans," said Gump through a mouthful of broth. "Sacrilege, that was. A mighty act of barbarism."
Nell imagined the Germans felt much the same way about the bombing of Dresden, but now was neither the time nor the place, and William not the person with whom to have such a discussion. So she bit her tongue and carried on pleasant, pointless conversation with Robin about the history of the village and the house at Blackhurst, until finally Robin excused herself to clear the plates and fetch some pudding. Nell watched her bustle from the room, Then, aware that it might be her last chance to speak with William alone, she seized the opportunity. "William," she said, "there's something I have to ask you."
"Ask away."
"You knew Eliza." He sucked on his pipe, nodded once. "So, why do you think she took me? Did she want a child, do you think?" William exhaled so that smoke plumed. He clenched the pipe in his back teeth and spoke around it.
"Doesn't sound right to me.
She was a free spirit, not the sort to welcome domestic responsibility, let alone steal it." "Was there any talk in the village? Did anyone have a theory?"
"We all believed that the child, that you, had fallen to the scarlet fever. No one questioned that part."
He shrugged.
"As for Eliza's disappearance, no one thought much of that, either. It wasn't the first time."
"No?"
"She'd done the same a few years before."
He glanced quickly towards the kitchen and lowered his voice, avoided Nell's eyes.
"Always blamed myself a bit for that. It was soon after the other thing I was telling you about. I confronted her, told her what I'd seen, called her all manner of names. She made me promise not to tell anyone, told me that I didn't understand, that it wasn't as it seemed." He laughed bitterly. "All the usual things a woman says when caught in such a situation."
Nell nodded.
"I did as she asked, though, and kept her secret. Not long after that, I learned in the village that she'd gone away."
"Where did she go?"
He shook his head. "When she finally got back, a year or so later it was, I asked her over and over, but she never would say."
"Pudding's up," came Robin's voice from the kitchen. William leaned forward, pulled his pipe from his mouth, and pointed it at Nell.
"That's why I had Robin ask you here tonight. That's what I wanted to tell you. Find out where Eliza went, and I reckon you'll be some of the way to figuring out your riddle. Because I can tell you something. Wherever it was she disappeared to, she was different when she came back."
"Different how?" He shook his head at the memory.
"Changed. Less herself, somehow."
He clenched his teeth on his pipe.
"There was something missing, and she was never the same again."
Part 3. Chapter 37. Blackhurst Manor, 1907. On the morning scheduled for Rose's return from New York, Eliza went early to the hidden garden. The November sun was still shrugging off sleep, and the way was dim, light just enough to reveal the grass, silver with dew. She went quickly, arms wrapped across her front against the chill. It had rained overnight, and puddles lay all about. She stepped around them as best she could, then creaked open the maze gate and started through. It was darker still within the thick hedge walls, but Eliza could have navigated the maze in her sleep. Ordinarily, she loved the brief moment of twilight as night anticipated dawn, but today she was too distracted to pay it any heed. Ever since she'd received Rose's letter announcing her engagement, Eliza had battled her emotions. The spiked barb of envy had lodged in her stomach and refused to grant her rest. Each day, when her thoughts turned to Rose, when she reread the letter, felt her imaginings slide towards the future, fear prickled her insides, filled her with their dread poison. For with Rosa's letter, the color of Eliza's world had changed. Like the kaleidoscope in the nursery that had so delighted her when she first came to Blackhurst, one twist and the same pieces had rearranged to create a vastly different picture. Where a week ago she had felt secure, enveloped in the certainty that she and Rose were irrevocably tied, now she feared herself alone again. By the time she entered the hidden garden, early light was sifting through the autumn sparse canopy. Eliza took a deep breath. She'd come to the garden because it was the place in which she always felt settled, and today, more than ever, she needed it to work its magic. She ran her hand along the little iron seat, beaded with rain, and perched on its damp edge. The apple tree was fruiting, shiny globes of orange and pink. She could pick some for cook, or perhaps she should tidy the borders, or trim the honeysuckle, apply herself in some way that would take her mind from Rose's arrival, the resistant fear that her cousin would be somehow changed when she returned. For in the days since Rose's letter, as Eliza had grappled with her envy, she had realized that it wasn't the man, Nathaniel Walker, whom she feared. It was Rose's love for him. The marriage she could bear, but not a shift in Rose's affection. Eliza's greatest worry was that Rose, who had always loved her best, had found a replacement and would no longer need her cousin most of all. She forced herself to stroll casually and appraise her plants. The wisteria was shedding its final leaves. The jasmine had long lost its flowers, but the autumn had been mild, and the pink roses were still in bloom. Eliza went closer, took a half-opened bud between her fingers, and smiled at the perfect raindrop caught within its inner petals. The thought was sudden and complete. She must make a bouquet, a welcome home gift for Rose. Her cousin was fond of flowers, but more than that, Eliza would select plants that were a symbol of their bond. There must be ivy for friendship, pink rose for happiness, and some of the exotic oak-leaved geranium for memories. Eliza chose each sprig carefully, making sure to pick only the finest stems, the most perfect blooms. Then she gathered the little bouquet together with a pink satin ribbon torn from her hem. She was tightening the bow when she heard the familiar sound of metal wheels jangling on the distant driveway stones. They were back. Rose was home. With her heart in her throat, Eliza hitched up her damp-hemmed skirts, clutched the bouquet, and began to run, zigzagging back and forth through the maze. She splashed through puddles in her haste, pulse hammering apace with the horse's hooves. She emerged from the gates just in time to see the carriage draw to a stop in the turning circle, paused a moment to catch her breath. Uncle Linus was sitting, as always, on the garden seat by the maize gate, his little brown camera beside him. But when he called to her, Eliza pretended not to hear. She arrived at the turning circle as Newton was opening the carriage door. He winked, and Eliza waved back, pressed her lips together as she waited. Since receiving Rose's letter, long days had bled into longer nights, and now the moment was finally upon her. Time seemed to slow. She was aware of her hurried breaths, her pulse still racing in her ears. Did she imagine the change in Rose's facial expression, the shift in her bearing? The bouquet slipped from Eliza's fingers, and she picked it up from the wet lawn. The motion must have caught in their peripheral vision, for both Rose and Aunt Adeline turned. One smiled, the other did not. Eliza raised her hand slowly and waved, lowered it again. Rose's eyebrows lifted with amusement. "Well, aren't you going to welcome me home, cousin?" Relief spread instantly beneath Eliza's skin. Her Rose was back, and all would surely be well. She started forward, began to run, arms outstretched. wrapped Rose in an embrace. "Stand back, girl," said Aunt Adeline. "You're covered in mud splatter. You'll mark Rose's dress." Rose smiled, and Eliza felt the sharp edges of her worry retract. Of course Rose was unaltered. She had been away only 2.5 months. Eliza had allowed fear to conspire with absence and affect an impression of change where there was none. "Cousin Eliza, how wonderful it is to see you." "And you, Rose." Eliza presented the bouquet. "How delightful." Rose lifted it to her nose. "From your garden?" "It's ivy for friendship, oak leaf geranium for memories." "Yes, yes, and Rose, I see. How darling of you, Eliza." Rose held the bouquet out towards Newton. "Have Mrs. Hopkins find a vase, won't you, Newton?"
"I've so much to tell you, Rose," said Eliza. "You'll never guess what's happened. One of my stories."
"Goodness me," Rose laughed. "I haven't even reached the front door, and my Eliza is telling me fairy tales."
"Stop tiring your cousin," said Aunt Adeline sharply. "Rose needs to rest."
She glanced towards her daughter, and a quaver of hesitation entered her voice.
"You should consider lying down."
"Of course, Mama. I intend to retire directly." The change was subtle, but Eliza noted it nonetheless. There was something unusually tentative in Aunt Adeline's suggestion, something less pliant in Rose's response. Eliza was still pondering this slight shift when Aunt Adeline started into the house, and Rose leaned close, whispered in Eliza's ear, "Now come upstairs, dearest. There's so much I have to tell you." And tell Rose did. She recounted every moment spent in Nathaniel Walker's company, and, more tediously, the anguish of each moment spent away from him. The epic tale began that afternoon and continued through night and day. In the beginning, Eliza was able to feign interest. Indeed, at the very first, she had been interested, for the feelings Rose described were like none she'd ever felt herself. But as the days wore on, grouped themselves into weeks, Eliza began to flag. She tried to interest Rose in other things, a visit to the garden, the newest story she had written, even a trip to the cove. But Rose had ears only for tales of love and forbearance, specifically her own. So it was, as the weeks cooled towards midwinter, Eliza sought more frequently the cove, the hidden garden, the cottage, places into which she could disappear, where servants would think twice before bothering her with their dreaded messages, always the same: "Miss Rose requires Miss Eliza's presence immediately on a matter of dire import." For it seemed that no matter how spectacularly Eliza failed to grasp the virtues of one wedding dress over another, Rose never tired of tormenting her. Eliza told herself that all would settle down, that Rose was just excited. She'd always loved fashions and decorations, and here was her chance to play the fairy princess. Eliza just needed to be patient, and all would return to normal between them. Then it was spring again. The birds returned from the bright beyond. Nathaniel arrived from New York. The wedding was upon them. And next Eliza knew, she was waving at the rear of Newton's carriage as it drew the happy couple towards London and a ship to the continent. Later that night, as she lay in her own bed in the bleak house, Eliza felt Rose's absence sharply. The knowledge formed clearly and simply. Rose would never again come to her room at night. Neither would Eliza go to Rose. They would no longer lie together and giggle and tell stories while the rest of the house slept. A special room was being prepared for the newlyweds in a distant wing of the house.
a larger room, with a view of the cove, far more befitting a married couple. Eliza turned onto her side. In the darkness she glimpsed finally how unbearable it would be to know herself beneath the same roof as Rose, and yet be unable to seek her out. Next day, Eliza sought her aunt. Found her in the morning room, writing at the narrow desk. Aunt Adeline made no acknowledgement of Eliza's presence, but Eliza spoke regardless. "I wondered, Aunt, whether certain items might not be spared from the attic."
"Items?" said Aunt Adeline, without shifting her attention from the letter she was penning.
"It is only a desk and chair that I require, and a bed."
"A bed?"
Dark eyes narrowed as her gaze swept sideways to meet Eliza's. In the clarity of night, Eliza had realized that it was better to make changes for oneself than try to mend holes torn by the decisions of others. "Now that Rose is married, it occurs to me that my presence might be less required in the house, that I might take up residence in the cottage." Eliza's expectations were low. Aunt Adeline drew particular pleasure from the issuing of denials. She watched as her aunt signed her letter with a careful signature, then scratched sharp fingernails on her hound's head. Her lips stretched into what Eliza took to be a smile, albeit slight. Then she stood and rang the bell. The first night in her new abode, Eliza sat by the upstairs window, watching the ocean swelling and subsiding like a great drop of mercury beneath the moon's lambent light. Rose was across that sea, somewhere on the other side. Once more her cousin had travelled by ship, and Eliza had been left behind. Some day, though, Eliza would set sail on her own journey. The magazine didn't pay much for her fairy tales, but if she kept writing and saved for a year, then surely she would be able to afford the voyage. And there was the brooch, of course, with its colored gems. Eliza had never forgotten Mother's brooch, tucked away inside the Swindle's fireplace. One day, somehow, she intended to retrieve it. She thought of the advertisement she'd seen in the newspaper the week before. "People wanted to travel to Queensland," it had said. "Come and begin a new life." Mary had often spun tales of her brother's adventures in the town of Maryborough. To hear her tell it, Australia was a land of open spaces and blinding sun, where the rules of society were flouted by most, and opportunity abounded for all to start afresh. Eliza had always imagined that she and Rose might travel together. They had spoken of it many times. Or had they? Looking back, she realized Rose's voice had been quiet when conversation touched upon such imagined adventures. Eliza stayed at the cottage every night. She bought her own produce from the market in the village. Her young fisherman friend, William, made sure she was well supplied with fresh whiting, and Mary dropped by most afternoons on her way home from work at Blackhurst, always bringing a bowl of cooked soup, some cold meat from the luncheon roast, and news from the house. Apart from such visits, for the first time in her life, Eliza was truly alone. In the beginning, unfamiliar sounds, nocturnal sounds, disturbed her. But as the days passed, she came to know them, soft-pawed animals in the eaves,